Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, October 24th, 2022. Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing indictments of two men suspected of being Chinese intelligence officers who attempted to obstruct a U.S. criminal investigation and prosecution of what he said was a large Chinese technology company. Wouldn't say specifically, but news reports say sounds a lot like Huawei. Attorney General also announcing charges against other Chinese nationals for bad actions in the U.S., including trying to send sensitive technology and equipment to China and harassing someone in the U.S. to get that person to return to China. Attorney General coming up in just a moment. Just a bit over 2 weeks until U.S. voters head to the polls, President Joe Biden visiting Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C., giving what he is calling a closing argument for voters to choose the Democrats, saying everybody wants to make it a referendum, but it's a choice between two vastly different visions of America. In Great Britain, the Conservative Party choosing former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak to be the next Prime Minister, and he's making history. He'll be the first British Prime Minister of color. In his first public address, he said, "We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together." And the Biden administration responding to Russia's claim that Ukraine is preparing to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb, calling it transparently false and a pretext for escalation. And we start at the Justice Department, where, as USA Today reports it, federal authorities unsealed charges Monday against a dozen people, including members of China's security and intelligence apparatus, for allegedly trying to exert influence in the United States to benefit their own country. Attorney General Merrick Garland spending about 5 minutes running through the details of all the cases.
Earlier today, in the Eastern District of New York, a complaint was unsealed charging two PRC intelligence officers with attempting to obstruct, influence, and impede a criminal prosecution of a PRC-based telecommunications company. The complaint alleges that in 2019, the defendants directed an employee at a U.S. government law enforcement agency to steal confidential information about the United States criminal prosecution of the company. The defendants believed that they had recruited the U.S. employee as an asset, but in fact, the individual they recruited was actually a double agent working on behalf of the FBI. As the complaint alleges, the defendants paid a bribe to the double agent to obtain non-public information, including files from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District. They did so in the hope of obtaining the prosecution strategy memo, confidential information regarding witnesses, trial evidence, and potential new charges to be brought against the company. The double agent provided the defendants with documents that appeared to present some of the information they sought. In fact, the documents were prepared by the U.S. government for the purpose of this investigation and did not reveal actual meetings, communications, or strategies. This was an egregious attempt by PRC intelligence officers to shield a PRC-based company from accountability and to undermine the integrity of our judicial system. Also earlier today, in the District of New Jersey, an indictment was unsealed charging four individuals, including three PRC intelligence officers, with conspiring to act in the United States as illegal agents on behalf of a foreign government. The indictment alleges that between 2008 and 2018, the defendants used the cover of a purported Chinese academic institute to target, co-opt, and direct individuals in the United States to further the PRC's intelligence mission. Those directives included attempts to procure technology and equipment from the United States and to have it shipped to China. They also included attempts to stop protected First Amendment activities, protests here in the United States, which would have been embarrassing to the Chinese government. Separately, in the Eastern District of New York, the Justice Department charged seven individuals who were working on behalf of the PRC with engaging in a multi-year campaign of threats and harassment to force a U.S. resident to return to China. Last Thursday, we arrested two of those defendants. Those activities were part of the PRC's global extra-legal effort known as Operation Fox Hunt. Its purpose is to locate and bring back to China alleged fugitives who have fled to foreign countries. including the United States. The PRC has a history of targeting political dissidents and critics of the government who have sought relief and refuge in other countries. The indictment alleges that the defendants, working at the direction of the government of the PRC, engaged in a campaign of harassment, threats, surveillance, and intimidation aimed at coercing the victim to return to China. We also allege that the defendants threatened and harassed the victim's family members, both in the U.S. and in China. The PRC government forced the victim's nephew to travel from China to the United States to convey the PRC's threats to the victim's son. The defendants threatened the victim, saying that, quote, coming back and turning herself in is the only way out. They showed up at the home of the victim's son in New York. They filed frivolous lawsuits against the victim and his son and said it would be, quote, endless misery for the defendant and son to defend themselves. And they made clear that their harassment would not stop until the victim returned to China. As these cases demonstrate, the government of China sought to interfere with the rights and freedoms of individuals in the United States and to undermine our judicial system that protects those rights. They did not succeed. The Justice Department will not tolerate attempts by any foreign power to undermine the rule of law upon which our democracy is based.
Attorney General Merrick Garland leading a news conference today at the Justice Department. On that first case that he talked about, in which he mentioned a large People's Republic of China technology company, wouldn't say later on when questioned by reporters which company, but the Washington Post writing, the details in the complaint closely track a prior case filed against Huawei. The U.S. Justice Department indicted Huawei Technologies in 2019, accusing the world's largest communications equipment manufacturer and some of its executives of violating U.S. sanctions on Iran and conspiring to obstruct justice related to the investigation, prompting furious condemnations from both the company and the country. That from the Washington Post. FBI Director Christopher Wray also at today's news conference. A reporter asking about the timing of today's announcement of indictments. It comes one day after the Chinese President Xi Jinping was named to a third five-year term as leader of the Chinese Communist Party, a break with tradition. And this from the Associated Press. He promoted allies who support his vision of tighter control over society and the struggling economy.
I was hoping one of you, maybe the FBI director, could talk a little bit about the timing of this announcement coming at the end of the party Congress and the beginning of Xi's third term, and whether what kind of a signal it is intended to send to China at this delicate political time. And then, Attorney General, I have a question for you as well about another large company. Okay, all right. Make sure you come back to me, please.
So we bring cases when they're ready. And that's probably the simplest answer and most straightforward answer to that. As far as what signal they send, if the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, continues to violate our laws, they're going to keep encountering the FBI.
The FBI Director Christopher Wray at today's Justice Department news conference. Find the full video at our video library, cspan.org. CNBC reports that shares of Chinese companies listed in the U.S. dropped sharply Monday after Beijing tightened President Xi Jinping's grip on power, souring investor sentiment for non-state-driven companies. Back in the U.S., Election Day is 15 days away. CBS News reports that early voting already underway in 34 states and the District of Columbia, and more than 7.5 million people have already voted, either in person or by mail. Some states have already smashed early voting records set in the presidential election of 2020. President Joe Biden visiting Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C. today, talking about what he says is a closing argument heading into the election, wanting voters to choose the Democrats.
I've been into about 31 districts or 31 places, going to a bunch between now and the election day. And, you know, I can't think of a more consequential election that I've been involved in and we've been involved in. You know, whether we maintain control of the Senate and the House is a big deal. And so far, we're running against the tide and we're beating the tide. But we just have 15 days until one of the most important elections in our lifetime. And it's going to shape the way this country looks like for the coming decade, for real. Now the polls have been all over the place. First of all, if you speak to most pollsters, they're not sure anymore, not about the outcome, but about polling. No, I'm not being facetious. It's awful hard to do it these days. It's awful hard to do it these days. Republicans ahead, Democrats ahead, Republicans ahead. But it's going to close, I think, with seeing one more shift. Democrats ahead in the closing day. So look. The last couple of weeks, I don't pay attention to anything having to do with the polls. I just pay attention to what's happened on the phone and we're knocking on doors. I'm here to deliver what I believe is a closing argument about what we need to do in the next 15 days to make a victory assured and make it clear that this election is a referendum. It's not a referendum, I should say. It's a choice. Everybody wants to make it a referendum, but it's a choice between two vastly different visions for America, significantly different. Democrats are building a better America for everyone, with an economy that grows from the bottom up and the middle out, where everyone does well. Republicans are doubling down on their mega, MAGA trickle-down economics that benefits the very wealthy, failed the country before, and will fail it again if they win. Democrats are lowering your everyday costs like prescription drugs, health care premiums, energy bills, and gas prices. Folks, Republicans have made it clear, at least they're being honest around this time. They're telling you exactly what they want to do if they win. They're going to increase everyday cost. Democrats are making sure the biggest corporations begin to pay not their fair share, but at least a bigger share than they've been paying. 15% is not a fair share, but it's a bigger share. Republicans will allow some of the biggest corporations to go back to paying zero in federal taxes after having made $40 billion, leaving the burden to teachers, nurses, firefighters, working folks to pay more of their fair share to keep things going. We, the Democrats, are the ones that are fiscally responsible. Let's get that straight now, okay? And we're investing in all of America, reducing everyday costs while also lowering the deficit at the same time. Republicans are fiscally reckless, pushing tax cuts for the very wealthy that aren't paid for, and exploiting a deficit that is making inflation worse. Look, folks, Democrats are going to protect Social Security and Medicare. Republicans have been very clear. They've stated boldly that they want to cut Social Security and Medicare, and to the point that they'll shut down the government, they say, and send the nation into default, which raises prices for everyone if we do not cut Social Security and Medicare. I ain't gonna do it.
President Biden is speaking at DNC headquarters, Democratic National Committee, in Washington, D.C., to staff and volunteers. The chair of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, was interviewed today about the election on Fox News Channel.
You're touring right now with Rick Scott all over the country. You're hitting a ton of states. We talk a lot about what appears to be good news for Republicans. But yet in some of the polling, three of the four congressional districts in Iowa are said to be contested. I don't know why. Maybe you can explain that. And in the early voting in Georgia, African-American turnout said to be substantial. Does that concern you? What does that say to you? How do you look at both of those states, Iowa and Georgia?
Yeah, so I look at Iowa. I mean, we knew Ashley Hinson was going to have a tough race. We're trying to take on Cindy Axne. We have a great candidate in Zach Nunn. I think Iowa's solid. You've got Chuck Grassley, obviously, and Kim Reynolds there. I think there's been some outlier polls that are just not hitting the mark there. Georgia, yes, early voting's up, which, first of all, totally shows that Joe Biden and Stacey Abrams were lying when they were saying these laws were Jim Crow 2.0 and we're going to suppress turnout. You've had record turnout in early voting. We feel good about it. The energy's on the Republican side. We feel good at the numbers we're seeing. And we think there's African-American voters coming out for Herschel Walker.
But you know,
and we hope this momentum carries through Election Day.
Ronna, you know who doesn't feel so good about things? Bernie Sanders. This is him on younger voter turnout. Watch here.
I am worried about the level of voter turnout among young people and working people who will be voting Democratic. Crime is a real issue. Violence is a real issue. This drug problem and the addiction to drugs and the violence the drug causes is a huge problem all over this country.
Yeah, but we cover this issue, these issues every day, and it wasn't until recently that the Democrats even started talking about this.
Yeah, I'm stunned to hear him say that, because the latter half of those conversations should be, and it's being caused by Democrats. Democrats support cashless bail. They support an open border. They're fine with defunding the police. I mean, this is what they've been pushing, and now we're seeing the aftermath of these dangerous policies, and people are waking up. The Democrats have chosen to ignore these issues, but they can't ignore what voters are dealing with every day when they worry about riding the subway, when they worry about their stores being looted, and Democrats, time and time again, have been pro-criminal, and that's what's hurting Fetterman and his race and Mandela Barnes in his race in Wisconsin.
Ronald McDaniel is chair of the Republican National Committee, interviewed today on Fox News Channel. More on election trends. C-SPAN spoke with Amy Walter, the Cook Political Report publisher and editor-in-chief.
The challenge for Democrats from the very beginning of the cycle is, can they win in states or in districts where the president's unpopular? And what we've been seeing in the polling, at least these polls in September and even in early October, are that many of the voters who put themselves not as strong disapprovers, right, not people who say, I absolutely cannot stand the president, because polls ask a stepped question, strongly approve, strongly disapprove, somewhat approve, somewhat disapprove. Those people in the somewhat disapprove, those are the people I call the meh people, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't really, truly dislike the guy, but I don't think he's doing a great job. Those folks were actually voting more for Democrats than we had seen in previous midterm years. It also helped to answer the question as to why so many Democratic candidates, especially Senate candidates, were doing so much better than Biden in states like Georgia or in Arizona. And it seems as if what we're getting is this, and the answer is these voters who, they're not crazy about Biden, but they also are not interested in voting for a Republican.
What explains
candidate.
Those Senate races tightening up, the Georgia race, the Pennsylvania race, Arizona, of course?
So this was always my question that I raised then, actually raised very early in the cycle, was how much can you overperform the president? So getting some of those meh voters is important, but can you get more than a small amount? Or are those Senate candidates, it's not that the race is necessarily tightening, it's that they hit their ceiling early on, right? They consolidated all those voters, including those who might not really approve of the job the president's doing, to give them a, let's say, 46, 47, 48% on the ballot.
And they're not getting any more.
And then you're kind of trapped there. And that's always the challenge in these, when you're looking as an incumbent and you're at 48%, it seems, oh, I just need to find 2% more. That is often easier said than done.
Well, before I get into the House, the broad House races out there, and without giving away the secret sauce of the Cook Political Report, as you look at all of the House and Senate races, what is it that your organization, that your writers and analysts are doing, looking at these individual, particularly when it comes to individual congressional House races?
That's right. So I think what we do is we look at it both from a 30,000 foot perspective, as well as getting in and on the ground perspective. So understanding the bigger, broader political environment, that's critically important, right? How do people feel about the president? How do people feel about the state of the country? How are people feeling about what the top issues are, which you all just talked about a minute ago? And then getting down into the individual races, which is what are the unique circumstances in those states that helped us to understand which way these races could go. The overall political environment, it drives about 90% of what happens in these races. The next 10% is what's going on the ground. And there are some Democrats, even as the winds are blowing up against their face, they're going to be able to overcome that. Mm. And there are some that won't.
So this seemed like a bit of a line of demarcation this summer after the Dobbs report,
That's right.
Dobbs decision.
there seemed to be wind in the sails of certainly some Democratic races. How has that changed?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, you know, earlier in the year, what you saw was maybe gale force winds or higher in the face of Democrats. It wasn't just that the president's job approval ratings were in some cases at all-time lows that we've seen for a first-term president, but inflation continued to bite. We were seeing more and more challenges that the administration was struggling with, and more important, we were spending a whole lot of time, if you think about the media narrative, where was our attention? It was on the things that the administration and Democrats were not doing, right? They weren't getting much done on Capitol Hill. They were fighting amongst themselves. We were hearing a whole lot about Joe Manchin and is he or isn't he going to support President Biden. Over the summer, the lens moved from being completely focused on Democrats to one that started to focus on the former president. We had the January 6th hearings.
Right.
We had the former president going and stumping for candidates all around the country who were running in primaries, Republican candidates, and stumping against many of the people that voted for impeachment.
Republicans who voted for
impeachment. So he was in the news a lot. He's also incredibly polarizing, much like the current president. And then, of course, as you said, then we had the Dobbs decision at the end of June. And so what you could feel was that instead of a wind that was category 4 or 5, the wind had lessened in the face of Democrats because the intensity on the side of Democrats in terms of their interest and engagement, that started to go up as the lens and the focus was on Trump and was on abortion access. And it wasn't as much on those things that were hurting Democrats.
What are the raw numbers now for the House? How many seats do the Republicans need to win to take control of the House, and where do you think that they stand right now?
Well, Republicans only need 5 seats to pick up, to net 5 seats to pick up control of the House. The challenge for Democrats is that they have many more vulnerable seats that we call toss-ups. Those are the closest races. There are over 30 of those right now. The lion's share of those, more than 20 of them, are ones held by Democrats. I think it's something like if Republicans, in order to win control of Congress, just the barest of majorities, would only need to win about 17 or 20% of the closest races that we have in that category. So the bar is significantly lower than, say, if they needed to pick up 50 seats or something like that. So the good news for Democrats is there aren't as many competitive races out there as there were, say, in 1994 or 2010 when Republicans made really big gains in the House.
Right.
There just are fewer and fewer Democrats that sit in districts that are conservative or are red-leaning. The House is mostly settled. Most members of Congress sit in a district that presidential candidate of their party carried.
Amy Walter is with the Cook Political Report, publisher and editor-in-chief, joining C-SPAN on this morning's Washington Journal program. You can find the full discussion with her, including all the listener and viewer calls, at our website, cspan.org. And every morning, join us at 7 Eastern for another Washington Journal, live on C-SPAN radio and television. From NBC News reporting over the weekend, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said the Biden administration is moving full speed ahead, preparing to implement its federal student debt forgiveness program after a federal appeals court hit pause on the administration's efforts. Secretary Cardona said in a video posted Saturday the administration is not deterred by lawsuits that seek to block its relief program. The suit, the latest one, brought by 6 Republican-led states, which allege the administration's program to forgive up to $20,000 per student, is unlawful because it wasn't voted on by Congress, and it would also cut some revenue that state entities profit from the federal student loans. Here's the latest today from the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Thank you. You just mentioned that 22 million people have applied to have their student loans forgiven. They are expecting to have some or all of their debt cleared. You called it game-changing. How confident is the White House in your authority to actually clear this debt? And do you have any concern that you may be giving millions of Americans false hope?
Look, the president was very clear that what he was trying to do. He was trying to make sure that we gave middle-class Americans who are feeling a tight squeeze, especially coming out of dealing with this pandemic, an opportunity to be able to take away the student debt that really holds people down, if you think about it, in order to start a family, in order to put money down on a house. And so the president's going to do everything that he can to make sure that we get this done. Again, I mentioned 22 million people have signed up, but this could help up to 40 million people. This is what this can do. Give almost 40 million people an opportunity. 90% of them make less than $75,000. That is a big deal. That is a game changer. So we're going to continue to work and make sure that people continue to apply. And I'll leave the legal process over to our counsel's office and the DOJ, actually. But again, it's not going to stop our message. We know that there are our opponents out there who don't want us to help middle-class Americans, but it's not going to stop us.
And you know, this legal fight could drag out for some time. Is there any chance that the president is considering extending the pause on federal student loan payments, which are set to expire in January, or is that off the table?
Look, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. We have to let the process play out and see where the process goes. So we're not going to get ahead of ourselves from here. It is a temporary order, right? So just want to make sure. Don't want to get ahead of any of this. It does not reverse the fact that a lower court the court dismissed the case. Let's not forget that, or suggest that the case has any merit at all. As I was saying at the top of the briefing, we will continue to move full speed ahead in our preparations and compliance with this order, of course, and we'll continue to urge bars to apply at studentaid.gov. But again, we're not going to get ahead of it. It's a temporary order, and so we're just going to let the process play out.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters in the White House briefing room. One of the states in that lawsuit, Nebraska, and the Attorney General there, Doug Peterson, a Republican, putting out a statement when this federal appeals court did put the program on hold. He said, "We're pleased the temporary stay has been granted. It's very important that the legal issues involving presidential power be analyzed by the court before transferring over $400 billion in debt to American taxpayers." Also today, the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas granting Senator Lindsey Graham's request that he, Senator Graham, not have to testify before a Fulton County, Georgia special grand jury for now in the investigation into whether Donald Trump's supporters interfered in the 2020 presidential election. Senator Graham, Republican from South Carolina, has been challenging the subpoena in court, saying that the Constitution's speech and debate clause shields him from any liability when he is performing official duties. Wall Street today, the Dow up 417, NASDAQ up 52, S&P up 44. Washington today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the C-SPAN Now mobile video app. Now to London and the selection of a new prime minister for Great Britain. The chair of the parliamentary group of the Conservative Party in the House of Commons, the chair is Sir Graham Brady, and that parliamentary group is officially known as the 1922 Committee. Graham Brady making the announcement today.
Good afternoon. As returning officer in the leadership election, I can confirm that we have received one valid nomination. And Rishi Sunak is therefore elected as leader of the Conservative Party. And you may wish to know the new leader of the party will address us in this room at 2:30. Thank you.
Sir Graham Brady, that video and audio from Sky News. He said there was only one name in contention. That was after two other possible candidates, Penny Mordaunt and former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, withdrew their names. It was Boris Johnson who resigned over the summer And then after a six-week campaign between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss emerged the winner by a vote of the Conservative Party membership in Great Britain to become the prime minister in early September. And then following a poor reception of her budget proposal by the markets and by her own party, she lost support of her membership last week and resigned. This time around, it didn't take 6 weeks. Conservative Party chose a new leader in just a couple of days. Rishi Sunak spoke to party members at Westminster, as you heard Sir Graham Brady mention. It wasn't in front of cameras, but Reuters reports that he told his lawmakers, it's unite or die, according to one person in the room, and that he told the party it faced an existential crisis and lawmakers should now focus on policy, not personalities. Then it was off to Conservative Party headquarters in London. That was public, and his fellow party members were there to greet him as the car pulled up.
Cameras at the ready. It looks like Rishi Sunak has arrived to quite the welcome party by MPs.
Outside Conservative Party headquarters in London, members of that party, still in the majority, greeting the person that will become the new prime minister. Inside, he spoke to them, and then he made a public speech, a minute and a half.
I'd like to pay tribute to Liz Truss for her dedicated public service to the country. She has led with dignity and grace through a time of great change and under exceptionally difficult circumstances, both at home and abroad. I am humbled and honoured to have the support of my parliamentary colleagues and to be elected as leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party. It is the greatest privilege of my life to be able to serve the party I love and give back to the country I owe so much to. The United Kingdom is a great country, but there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together, because that is the only way we will overcome the challenges we face and build a better, more prosperous future for our children and our grandchildren. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility, and I will work day in, day out to deliver for the British people.
The Guardian newspaper writes that Rishi Sunak, whose parents are of Punjabi Indian heritage, will be the first person of color to become British Prime Minister. He's not the first minority ethnic prime minister. Benjamin Disraeli, who held the office twice between 1868 and 1880, was of Jewish heritage. And at 42, Rishi Sunak is the youngest prime minister for more than 200 years. Rishi Sunak expected to meet with King Charles III on Tuesday, and the king will formally ask him to form the new government, and then he will become the prime minister. The British Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, the opposition party in the House of Commons currently, has been calling for a general election, something which under British law needs to happen at least every 5 years, and the next one now does not have to happen until January 2025. Keir Starmer was interviewed on LBC Radio in Great Britain early this morning. It was after it was known that the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson would not be seeking his old job, and when it was fairly certain that Rishi Sunak would be the next Prime Minister.
We've had what now? This will be the fifth Prime Minister in six years. Yeah. We've had four Chancellors in 4 months. That isn't the country we are. That is utter chaos. And I think many people listening would be saying, oh, for heaven's sake, at least give us the choice between a stable Labour Party coming in to govern the country, get the economy under control and actually deliver for working people, or carry on with this utter chaos.
Lastly, coming to the calls, John, you'll be the caller. Final one from me. How do you view the prospect of squaring up to Rishi Sunak at PMQs?
Absolutely fine. I mean, I don't know whether it'll be him. Obviously, there's a few hours to run, although it looks to me like he's obviously the front runner at the moment. We'll see. But as I say, I've said, Nick, many, many times, I don't mind who I'm up against. there. I will make my case for a positive Labour government to steer us out of this chaos.
Keir Starmer is the leader of the Labour Party in Great Britain, the opposition. It was on LBC radio in Britain this morning. And then later on, it was official that Rishi Sunak will become the new prime minister. And you mentioned PMQs. That's Prime Minister's Question Time. C-SPAN has brought you this from the House of Commons in London for many years. You can watch the new prime minister Wednesday, 7 a.m. Eastern, on C-SPAN 2 television. Watch anywhere on our mobile video app. And we'll be airing Prime Minister's Questions later on in our schedule here on C-SPAN Radio. White House says that President Biden looks forward to speaking with the new prime minister once it becomes official. This from CNN, Ukraine has invited experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, to the country to disprove unsubstantiated Russian claims that Kyiv plans to use a dirty bomb, Ukraine's foreign minister has said. In a tweet on Monday, Dmytro Kuleba said that he had spoken by telephone to the director general of the IAEA. He said, "In my call, I officially invited IAEA to urgently send experts to peaceful facilities in Ukraine, which Russia deceitfully claims to be developing a dirty bomb." He agreed, "Unlike Russia, Ukraine has always been and remains transparent. We have nothing to hide." Ukraine, the U.S., and other Western officials have dismissed Russia's claims that Ukraine is planning to use the so-called dirty bomb as a Russian false flag operation. All this came up at today's State Department briefing in Washington with the spokesperson, Ned Price.
Just in terms of the comments that we've been hearing from Russian officials and the response to those comments from you guys, from the French, from the Brits, and I noticed that there was a call today, another one between the Gerasimov and the British chief of staff, I guess, is what you would call him, basically outlining the same things. That they think that the Ukrainians are going to, or they accuse the Ukrainians of plotting to use a dirty bomb and that they will respond in kind. So without getting into what happened over the weekend and what has already been said, is there anything new that you guys have to say on this topic today?
Well, you asked that we not get into the weekend, but I think the weekend is important context for what we're speaking to, because over the weekend, you did hear and you saw a number of calls take place, not only from senior officials here in Washington, but from capitals in Europe. And you saw a remarkably consistent message in those readouts of those calls, as well as in the joint statement that we put out last night with the forbearance of our French and British partners who were working late, early into this morning, I should say, to finalize it, that made clear that we're concerned when we hear this type of patently false disinformation emanating from the Kremlin. We know the Kremlin's track record when it comes to these types of claims. That's what, of course, what is the predicate, what ultimately undergirds our concern. We reject the transparently false allegation that Ukraine is preparing to use a dirty bomb on its own territory. That was a message you saw in the readouts in the joint statement that we issued yesterday. And then just today, you saw from Ukrainian Foreign Minister Kuleba. He put out a statement about his call with Director General Grossi of the IAEA, and Foreign Minister Kuleba said in that statement that he invited the IAEA to, quote, urgently send experts to peaceful facilities in Ukraine, which Russia deceitfully claims to be developing a dirty bomb. And the IAEA has agreed. Secretary Blinken will be meeting later today with Director General Grossi of the IAEA. I imagine this will be a topic of discussion. The broader point, and again, you heard this not only from us, but from our European allies as well, is that the world would see through any Russian attempt to use this allegation as a pretext for escalation. We wanted to be very clear in our calls, in our joint statements, in the readouts of those calls today, and some of which have started yesterday and that have continued today. We wanted to send a very clear message that Any such effort would be transparent. Any such effort would not fool the world.
The State Department spokesman Ned Price at today's news conference in Washington. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi making a surprise trip to Croatia to take part in the first parliamentary summit of the International Crimea Platform. That group has a goal of returning the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine. Russia has occupied Crimea since 2014 and claims it now as part of Russia. During a joint news conference with the Croatian Prime Minister, Speaker Pelosi asked about U.S. support for Ukraine and how it might change if Democrats lose control of the House and/or Senate.
Marius, Bloomberg News. Madam Speaker, you just spoke about the midterm elections. Are you concerned in the case that GOP takes the Congress? What would be the result? What would be the effect for the U.S. aid for Ukraine? And speaking about that, are you concerned about manipulation at the ballot box, initiatives like One More Mission and similar?
Well, why don't we just stick with the subject at hand today, and your first question is to that point. I believe that the support for Ukraine and the people of Ukraine, their courage and the military support and refugee support and the rest that the U.S. Is supplying, again, learning from some of the experiences of our European friends, including and starting with Croatia, will not stop. It is the support for Ukraine is bipartisan. It is bicameral. That means in the House and in the Senate. And it starts in the White House with our president. His prioritizing this springs from the work that he has been doing with friends, allies, listening to them, having unity as we go forward on how we address this crisis. So I wouldn't be, someone made a statement of we're not giving a blank check to Ukraine. We've never given a blank check to Ukraine. The Ukrainians have dealt with any assistance we have given them, and I'm sure you have given them, with great integrity, with great compliance, with great accountability, and with great transparency. So the inference to be drawn from that is we wouldn't be giving them help. That's not true. And that there has been a blank check. That's not true. This has been a relationship of great integrity for democracy and freedom throughout the world.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, in Zagreb, Croatia, at a news conference with the Prime Minister of Croatia. That audio and video is well fed by the speaker's website. That blank check reference that she made, it was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, in an interview to Punch Bowl News last week. And Congressman McCarthy is in line to become House Speaker if Republicans get a majority in the House after the elections in 2 weeks. Punch Bowl News quoting Kevin McCarthy, "I think people are going to be sitting in a recession and they're not going to write a blank check to Ukraine. They just won't do it." That's part of it. You can find the full quote at the Punch Bowl website. At the White House today, President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden hosting a reception to celebrate Diwali. Voice of America reports that the festival symbolizing the victory of light over darkness is celebrated by Hindus, Jains, Sikhs across the world, especially in India. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre telling reporters earlier this month that the president sees Diwali as important, along with U.S. partnership with India and Indian Americans. Well, Vice President Kamala Harris's mother was born in India, and the vice president spoke today.
As with so many cultures, Diwali reminds us to see the light in our world, in each other, and in ourselves. We also are reminded to shine our light in the darkness, to fight for peace, for justice, for understanding, even as powerful forces work to sow hate and division. We remember that in these moments where we see darkness, our light shines the brightest. That is part of what we are reminded of in Diwali. In moments of darkness, we see the light. So today, as we celebrate Diwali, let us continue to make real the ideals of our nation, the ideals of freedom, democracy, and equality for all. Together, let us, all together, light the way toward a better future.
Vice President Kamala Harris at the White House celebration of Diwali today. Voice of America article notes that the celebration at the White House of this festival dates back to President George W. Bush and continued through Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Earlier in the day, singer Mary J. Blige joining First Lady Jill Biden at the White House to help kick off a new initiative led by the American Cancer Society to better prevent, detect, and treat breast and cervical cancer. It's part of the Beau Biden Cancer Moonshot Initiative, named after the president's son who died of brain cancer in 2015, and has the goal of cutting U.S. cancer death rates in half over the next 25 years.
I'm here today as a Black woman who is passionate about using my platform to encourage other women to prioritize their health, namely their annual well women's visits, mammograms, Pap plus HPV tests. I lost aunts, not an aunt, but several family members to breast cancer, grandmother to cervical cancer, lung cancer, and it just keeps going on and on and on and on every time I look around. Before we ever even knew they were sick, because the practice of not wanting other people in our business and keeping these topics to ourselves is so deeply rooted into our culture. It wasn't until many years later that I learned that being proactive about our health is not something we should keep to ourselves. That's why I've dedicated a great deal of my time to increasing awareness of the importance of preventative screenings, reminding people that their health is their wealth, and urging them to make it a priority. It's not always easy, we all know that. Time is a huge barrier for all women. There are also a lot of misconceptions about mammograms. And for Black women, many fear a cancer diagnosis and becoming a burden to the family if diagnosed. And while the screening rate for Black women and white women are comparable, Black women are more likely to be screened at lower resource facilities and also experience longer intervals between detection, diagnosis, and treatment. That's why milestones like Breast Cancer Awareness Month and the work you all are doing here over the next few days is so important. I'm convinced that if all my aunts, my godmother, my grandparents would have the opportunity to see a campaign like the ones on which I partner with the Black Women's Health Imperative that directed them to go for information, they would have a different outcome today.
Singer Mary J. Blige at the White House, the program co-hosted by the American Cancer Society. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word, to get stories Washington is talking about every day sent to your inbox. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.